This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We really want to capitalize on where the world's energy system is going and see smart, clean energy as the best possible energy product to be selling. And that's good for American business as well as good for the global climate equation.
Last week, we spoke about the prospect of decentralized energy systems supplying clean electricity to the developing world with Daniel Kamen, a UC Berkeley professor. This week on Sea Change Radio, the second part of that discussion. Then we learn about vampire electricity and the latest home efficiency innovations from Alan Meyer, a scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Daniel Kamen. He's a professor of energy at UC Berkeley. So if this vision comes true and the lights go on all over the globe, the short term, if it's clean energy, renewable energy, that should be great. We can get our greenhouse gas emissions down and people will become more educated and there'll be less oppression in the world. But from a longer term perspective, what happens if we have just this population boom and an industrial revolution that goes along with it, which may not have as many clean energy solutions? Or are you confident that the technology will have caught up by the time people in sub-Saharan Africa are ready to drive cars, that these cars are all be electric cars?
There's two questions embedded in this. One is, where are we going population-wise, which we can only forecast. We don't know for sure. And is the clean energy resource large enough to meet all these needs? And population, big mystery, controversial topic. But the energy resources to meet the needs of today's population worldwide and potentially where we're going, which could be 9 to 11 billion, is there. The clean energy resource is large enough. Do we need new market mechanisms and a great expansion of the interconnection technology to bring it to everyone? We do. But we're already seeing in the cases of distributed microenergy with hydropower in Bhutan and large amounts of solar and biomass in East Africa and distributed wind in Central Europe, we are already seeing that clean energy resource is certainly large enough to meet the needs, but it takes a level of interconnectivity of a grid system, whether it's local or regional, a so-called smart grid, to make it happen. Whether we will build that smart energy system fast enough so that we can rely on clean energy, or whether we rely on natural gas and coal, is the question. And what we see is, on a climate basis, we cannot rely on those fossil systems, even though they look like simpler opportunities. You need to meet a lot of people's energy needs, build a big coal plant. Well, we see the health and the environmental downsides of that often trumping the energy you would get out of it. And in fact, we've seen a number of places where you can build the clean energy system, solar, wind, biomass, much more rapidly and serve more people more immediately than waiting for a big coal plant. And so if you focus your system on this clean energy agenda, what we found in this paper is that you really can beat fossil fuels at the game of not just providing access, but providing it more rapidly than you would get from the old energy system.
So this may lead to a little bit too much of an inside baseball explanation, but in terms of your methodologies and you're breaking down a country's success in transitioning to clean energy, what are some of the bellwether metrics that you look at? What is the litmus test for seeing that a country's on the right path? Is it lack of coal, or is it producing X amount of gigawatts from solar?
I actually find that it's that the amount of fossil fuel resource is the poorest indicator, because ultimately much of that fossil fuel has to be left in the ground. So I often say that the long term, the best use of those fossil fuels is to keep the ground up and leave them in the ground, they are in the long term not the best resource. In some places, they're not the best resource right now. In East Africa, geothermal power plus solar is cheaper than the fossil fuel options. Not with some subsidy, but cheaper today, flat out.
Do they have an option, or you mean cheaper for a government?
No, I mean cheaper, period, no footnotes, no caveats. The cheapest form of new energy generation in Kenya is geothermal, and it's 8 cents a kilowatt hour. Diesel, which is their backup option today, is 35 cents, so it's not even close. So with the same dollar, whether it's national money or developed money, geothermal, easy answer.
On a grid level, or is this on a
even
community?
Distributed. There are small-scale geothermal that cost around 10 or 12, and there's large-scale geothermal.
10 or 12 what?
Cents per kilowatt hour.
Okay.
That's the same cost as electricity in California.
Yeah, that's what solar costs.
That's right. And so what we're saying is that geothermal is cheaper than fossil. Solar is cheaper than fossil. Wind is not easy from household to household, but the largest wind farm in Africa is going in Kenya. So there are places today already where, even though Kenya also has large amounts of coal and they've discovered oil recently, they have uranium, that this is a place where the renewables actually just win out pure on economics. Now, that doesn't mean that a given government is going to choose that route because we're used to the old style energy system. But the pure economics are favor renewables. And ironically, in many places, the issue is how quickly can you bring energy access to people in rural areas? And it's a fact that it's faster to bring these distributed clean energy systems than to wait to build big infrastructure for coal or natural gas. And so the economics and the resource mix favor clean energy, but our economic system is largely tied to the old world, and that favors incumbents. And the incumbents are coal, oil, and big hydro. And so the transition is possible, but it takes leaders with innovative policies. And so places like Kenya and Bangladesh and Nicaragua have made very clear efforts to favor renewables in terms of bringing power to the people. And those places that have set up clear policies are seeing that transition move much quicker than places that have not set up that kind of vision around green energy.
Why is coal and Kosovo integral to this vision of the future in parts of Europe?
So Kosovo is a really interesting case for a bunch of reasons. Small post-war country sitting on a very large amount of very low quality coal. Kosovo has blackouts. There are real power shortages. And so one approach to let's simply solve the energy access problem in Kosovo by building what we can do the most quickly. One vision of that is let's build another coal plant because they have some of the oldest and dirtiest coal plants in Europe. So they have a lot of coal. It is very close to the capital. Build a new coal plant. Well, I was just in Kosovo and Albania for a week and a half just recently. And what we found in a series of detailed technical and economic studies was that while you could build the coal option, there are serious problems of if they do that, they'll have to move people. So there is a migration problem. There's a resettlement issue. The coal plant is 6 miles from the capital, and Kosovo is geographically kind of a bowl with mountains on either side. And so you burn coal in that basin, and you have a significant health impact. And there was a very major study done by the Harvard School of Public Health indicating a very high health damage from the coal option. And then we find that Kosovo has a very good solar resource. It has a massive hydropower resource, which they share with Albania. And Kosovo and Albania have recently combined their energy markets. They have a very good wind resource. They have a lot of biomass. We found that the clean energy option in Kosovo is just simply cheaper than the fossil option. Not with subsidies, but simply cheaper. But it takes a bold vision to say we're going to invest in a distributed system versus the traditional centralized one.
Is there also the issue of employment in this area where people have generations of coal miners?
Well, in fact, old coal mines are nowhere near as income generating as investing in energy efficiency and solar and wind. So there is a bigger job opportunity by going clean.
I just mean politically, like what you see in West Virginia or Kentucky in the coal belt of Appalachia, like even though it doesn't actually add up, there's still that pushback.
There is an incumbent mentality in lots of places, even if the health, jobs, and other benefits are larger for the clean energy path. it is untested, and so there is a risk in taking the step into this new world. And so when we look at the Kosovo situation, the international community and the World Bank are looking to lend Kosovo a significant amount of money to build a new power plant. When we run the numbers, we find that that same amount of money would go much further if invested in renewables. But there's over a decade worth of planning around new coal plant, and so there is a planning and a political and a bureaucratic inertia to be overcome if you invest in the clean energy plan. From our assessment, very clearly a superior choice, but it's one that requires a new approach to energy, and that comes with risk. You've got the power to open the door.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Daniel Kamen. He's a professor of energy at UC Berkeley. You've been studying this area for several decades. This must be a very exciting time after having to hope that the prices will become tenable 10, 20 years ago.
Well, it's rather nice, actually, because myself and many others have been forecasting where the prices are going to be based on scale up and research and then and manufacturing of all these clean energy technologies, solar, wind, biomass, geothermal, and they're coming true exactly as predicted. And so between 2015 and 2020, we see around the world, solar becomes directly cost competitive with many of the fossil options. Wind is already cheaper than the fossil options at large scale. And that means the places that have big evolved grids, it makes sense today. In places without grids, it's often an infrastructure question because wind farms often have to be in remote areas, logistically challenging to get to. And so it varies place by place. But you're right, this is a time when we are seeing that transition that we've forecast and analyzed and worked for on a policy basis for a long time, now becoming directly an economically viable competitor.
And in this country, if we're looking at a Republican Congress and presidency in 2016, how much damage could a head-in-the-sand administration do to roll back the progress that's been made? Are the prices already so compelling that this is going to happen with or without good policy, or do we still need good economic incentives from the top down to enable this vision to happen in this country?
Good policies are really still critical, and I think it's inevitable we will go the way of clean energy over time, but without pushing it ahead, we may go there too slowly because we only have a couple decades to solve the climate problem. And so an enlightened administration that sees the job benefits, the health benefits, the global leadership potential of being that clean energy deployer are very high. And so there are things that a U.S. administration in 2016, be it Republican, Democrat, whatever, really could do to enable this process. One is certainly having national clean energy standards. A second one is having a price on carbon, whether it's through a market mechanism, a cap and trade system, or whether it's through a carbon price. Those things would dramatically accelerate the process, would generate more jobs in the United States, would also position the United States to really be the global deployer of clean energy systems. We think that China is the manufacturer of our solar and wind technology, but the hardware is really only a small fraction of the story. Increasingly, it's the interconnections. It is the grid in a box or grid outside the box, if you will.
Maintenance and upgrades.
Not just maintenance and upgrade, but also making sure that the power is always on. The more you rely on intermittent sources, solar and wind, the more you need a smart grid. the countries that make those smart grid, those meters, like we see with Nest and various technologies, those are the tools of a clean energy system. And the United States is the global leader in those methodologies and those technologies to build smart grid systems. And so if we really want to capitalize on where the world's energy system is going, we would kind of take a message from this paper we've written and see smart, clean energy as the best possible energy product to be selling. And that's good for American business as well as good for the global climate equation.
So where can people read this article? We're going to link on Sea Change Radio to it, but why don't you steer our listeners to other resources?
Right. So our paper, Nature Climate Change, is part of a whole series. And we make all of these publications available for free, not just the papers, but also the data sets on the website of my laboratory, which is rail.berkeley.edu. So that's rael.berkeley.edu, where we make all these available. And we have a whole series of planned publications and projects around making the technologies available, understanding how solar can transform certain areas, how energy efficiency, which we haven't talked about a lot today, is the critical feature, and having the most efficient appliances in places with small amounts of energy, the most efficient televisions, the most efficient lights, the most efficient refrigerators and freezers. That's the way to enable all these things. And so if there's one other thread in this story, it's the most efficient technologies to use this clean energy is absolutely critical. And the worst way to go is to use large amounts of clean energy when you don't have to. The best way to go is to use as judiciously as you need small amounts of clean energy because you've made sure that the system is absolutely as efficient as possible.
Professor Daniel Kamen, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Since we didn't really get a chance to cover electricity efficiency issues with Dr. Kamen earlier in the show, let's dig into the Sea Change Radio archives and hear my discussion with Alan Meyer of Lawrence Berkeley National Labs, where we talk about vampire power. My guest on Sea Change Radio is Alan Meyer. He's a scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Alan, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much.
Alan, what do these terms vampire power and standby power mean, and how recently did they come into our vernacular?
What most people think about with standby power, vampire power, and these other terms is the electricity used by appliances while they're switched off or not performing their primary purpose. The term vampire actually is kind of curious. I'm not sure who invented it, but it refers to the small black cubes that we've known for so long now and learned to love, I suppose. They have two prongs in them, like teeth, and they suck electricity and also suck electricity all night. So therefore, they're called vampires.
And you and your colleagues have been at the forefront of this research. What started the journey?
Quite a while ago, I began to notice that the miscellaneous uses of energy were significant in homes. Miscellaneous electricity is the electricity consumed by appliances that are not the major appliances. They're the smaller ones or the ones that aren't very common. So that might be everything from the microwave oven to the waterbed heater to your well pump to the aquarium to all sorts of things that are not the common uses of electricity like refrigerators or air conditioners or heaters. And so what we found is this miscellaneous use of electricity was fairly large and appeared to be growing. In fact, we found in our estimates that this miscellaneous use of electricity was about 20% of residential electricity use. And as I began to explore that end use, that miscellaneous use, we noticed that there were also these appliances that continued to draw electricity even while they were switched off, and that they also were important. And I began to switch my attention to these unique appliances that, for one reason or another, drew a lot of power when they were off. And that was, of course, standby power. Then I was probably the first person who put it all together and realized that there were all these appliances, and if you added up how much electricity was being consumed by these appliances while they were switched off, we realized that this probably represented at least 5% of residential electricity use, and it was growing. That 5%, and this was over 15 years ago now, that 5% represented a large number of nuclear power plants or large power plants of any kind, somewhere around 8 of them around the United States, and altogether in the world represented about 1% of the world's CO2 emissions. So that struck me as both small, but at the same time, you think 1% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions are occurring because these products that are switched off are still consuming some electricity.
And what are some of the steps that you and your team have been working on to chip away at that 1%?
So we spent a good deal of time trying to figure out exactly why this power was necessary, and then how one could reduce it, and what was economic to reduce, and what sorts of policies might be effective in reducing it. And we found, for example, that there were new technologies available that made it possible to greatly reduce standby power in many, many products, from televisions to audio equipment to, of course, cell phone chargers, battery chargers, and many other appliances. At that point, I proposed that we have a kind of international agreement that we would reduce the standby power in all of our appliances to below 1 watt per appliance. Over time, that proposal seemed to catch people's attention and became adopted as both local, state, national, and global policies in many parts of the world. And so you will even see that George Bush created an executive order requiring federal agencies to buy products that use less than 1 watt of standby power.
Current flowing to and fro makes a circuit of
electricity, electricity.
Voltage is the pressure that makes it go. It's pushing up
electricity, electricity.
Watts will tell you just how much you'll be using up
electricity, electricity.
Powerful stuff, so watch that plug. It's potent.
Electricity.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Alan Meyer. He's a scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Has the popularity of these large flat-screen TVs had an impact on our standby power consumption?
Televisions have made extraordinary progress in reducing their standby power consumption. The manufacturers now provide televisions that use less than 1 watt in standby. And it's been an amazing improvement. The only problem with that is that these televisions sometimes never get into that mode. Since then, we have seen a situation where there are new functional modes or operational modes slightly higher than this lowest mode. So they may still be drawing 3, 4, maybe 8 watts because they are connected to other products that force it to be at a higher level. Let's go back a little bit to 10 years ago, and even today, because many of those 10-year-old products still remain in our homes. We have many kinds of audio products. These may be stereos. They may be these desktop or shelf audio component systems. You will discover that these draw anywhere from 1 watt to 25 watts. They are basically the same devices, but because of differences in design, they have very different levels of standby power consumption. The set-top box, though, is probably the largest and the most important because it can typically draw in American homes 15 to 25 watts. That is to say, it's a cable box or a satellite box. Sometimes it has a hard disk spinning in it, the DVR. Together, that can be, in some cases, as much as 40 watts. So if you buy a TiVo, if you have an old TiVo, then it uses as much as a new refrigerator in terms of electricity. Even if you aren't using the features, if it's just plugged in, it's consuming as much as your refrigerator.
So you think you're saving some money maybe by going on Craigslist and getting an old TiVo for next to nothing, but it actually is going to cost you a lot more in the end and leave a much larger carbon footprint.
That's correct.
One of the things that all these companies are trying to do is to make them more energy efficient. Some of the larger companies like a Comcast cable or the larger cable companies, the DirecTV dish networks, the larger satellite companies, are those companies taking some aggressive steps to eliminate that high 40 watt vampire power, standby power threshold that you're talking about?
You identified an intriguing problem because the service providers, the television service providers like Comcast and Verizon and Cox, are in an unusual position. They provide you a box as part of the service, but you pay the electricity consumption of that box. So they have little interest in reducing the energy of that box because it's invisible, and they don't pay for it. So the result is, until recently, they have not been at all involved or concerned about improving the efficiency of the boxes. In fact, their principal goal has been to ensure maximum reliability, no callbacks.
And can you give me some examples of where technological improvement has reduced standby power consumption?
Probably the largest single innovation has been in the power supply. That is to say, the device that converts the 115-volt alternating current into direct current, which is what most of the consumer electronics needs to operate. And that change, the innovation there has been from what are called linear power supplies to switch mode power supplies. And you can always recognize a linear power supply because if you lift it up, it's heavy. It's got a lot of iron in it. But a switch mode power supply is very light because it's got electronics in it, and not very much at that. These devices are much more efficient. That is to say, the switch mode power supplies are much more efficient than the linear units.
And what kind of products are you seeing that for?
The products where the switch modes are now most common and are being driven to the lowest levels are the power supplies or chargers for your telephones. These new switch mode power supplies draw essentially nothing when they are not actually charging it for the limited number of hours where they're charging your phone. So if you leave them plugged into a power strip, you know, we're talking about maybe a few cents a year now. They are so low in power consumption.
Did that used to be a problem 10 years ago?
They used to be a problem, but now they are not.
Alan Meyer, scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, thank you so much for being our guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Hot Chocolate and the Steve Miller Band. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. and tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.